Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton. Glad you could listen today. If you've never heard of Orson Scott Card, you're missing out on some of the most enjoyable and thought-provoking fiction written in the late 20th century. Author of some 24 novels, several short story collections, and a couple of books about writing, Card's books are in millions of hands. His novel Ender's Game won both the Hugo and Nebula Awards and was included in the Modern Library Board's 100 Best Books Readers Poll on the Internet. Though you will generally find Orson Scott Card's books in the science fiction section, his trademark is simply great storytelling, stories about human beings facing great odds and huge moral challenges. Orson Scott Card's books have his latest book, that is, has just been released, and it is entitled Shadow of the Hegemon, published by Tor Books. Shadow of the Hegemon is a sequel to his previous bestseller, Ender's Shadow, which was a sort of parallel novel to the original Ender's Game. We'll let him talk about the latest book and anything else as we talk with Orson Scott Card in this hour. For those of you around Central Illinois, you'll have a chance to meet Orson Scott Card in person this evening at 7 o'clock at Pages for All Ages Bookstore in Savoy. He'll be there tonight to talk about his work and to sign your copies of his books. So if you'd like, you can attend that, and you are more than welcome. You're also more than welcome to call in this morning as we talk with Orson Scott Card. Those of you around Champaign-Urbana can use our number within the 217 area code 333-9455. Those of you elsewhere can call us on our toll-free line. That is 800-222-9455. Again, around Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL, if you match the letters with the numbers. Toll-free anywhere else, 800-222-WILL. Orson Scott Card has won so many awards, it's hard to mention them all without running out of time here. He's the recipient of 4 Locus Awards and a World Fantasy Award, and was the first to win both the Hugo and Nebula Awards for Best Novel 2 years in a row. His works have been translated into many languages, and he has taught at several universities and at the Cape Cod Writers' Workshop. He has degrees from Brigham Young University and the University of Utah. He lived in Brazil for 2 years as an unpaid missionary for the Mormon Church, and he currently lives in North Carolina with his wife and 5 children, all named after great novelists. Orson Scott Card, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
We had a chance to talk about a year and a half ago, so
I appreciate
your return visit. I hear this is to be your last formal book tour.
That's certainly my resolve.
Yeah. You seem to be one of the most outgoing and personable authors, but I imagine the tours could take a toll on anyone.
Well, it's meeting with my readers is a wonderful thing, and I intend to keep doing that from time to time. It's just this solid 2 weeks away from home and traveling that begins to wear you down after a while. I'm not a little kid anymore, you know. When I was 25, I could do this kind of thing with ease, but now I need my sleep.
Right. I was at the last event at Pages for All Ages, and you certainly were forthcoming, and it was just great to hear you talk about what you think about your work.
Well, if you were there, you remember then that I have no shortage of opinions. I sometimes don't have any information on which to base them, but that's never hampered me. I'm a fiction writer, so I'm able to just bowl right through and make things up as I need to. So I don't know how seriously to take me, but I enjoy babbling as long as there's an audience willing to listen.
Okay. Well, let's babble on here. Tell us about Shadow of the Hegemon and why you chose to tell that story the way you did.
Well, oddly enough, I really didn't plan it to be a series the way that it has turned into. I was going to simply write a book about Bean. I was going to have a few chapters that took place in battle school that paralleled Ender's Game and then move right on in the same book. But as with some of my other books, the story sort of got out of hand. I became interested in minor characters, and it just took longer to get where I was going, so that the first few chapters turned into an entire novel that was exactly parallel to Ender's Game. And so really what I'm doing is just continuing the original story that I meant to tell in one volume that's simply spreading out over several. There will be 4 Shadow books now, and I'm determined to stick to exactly 4. Those who followed my Alvin Maker series know that sometimes I can get really out of control, but this time we'll finish it up with the next 2 books, Shadow Puppets and The Shadow of the Giant.
I don't think anyone would really object if you kept it going, actually.
Well, except that if it's too open-ended, you begin to think, oh, he's just, you know, he can make this go on forever, and I don't think that's really fair to the readers. There is a finite story in mind. I suppose that I'm rather notorious for ending my series by having my lead character die, And that will happen with this one indeed. Those who have read Ender's Shadow know exactly how the main character will die, because I've already told you. But the truth is that, you know, death is how every life ends. And what I do is basically structure these as the biographies of the leading characters, and it follows that path from childhood through whatever age they achieve before dying.
The original book, Ender's Game, there was a character named Bean who becomes the focus of the other two books, Ender's Shadow and Shadow of the Hegemon. Did that happen? Was that a planned sort of way of exploring the topic? Did he sort of just, you know, start to write his own story?
Well, you know, 5 years from now, I'll probably talk about the grand design. But
yeah.
Right now, I still remember correctly that I had no such plan at all. I never meant to go back to the beginning of Ender's Game. In fact, I really never planned to write the novel of Ender's Game. I had written it as a short story. It was my first sale at the beginning of my publishing career. And only went back to write Ender's Game because I needed to set up the sequel, Speaker for the Dead, in a much better way than the short story would. And in this case, I only went back to write about Bean because we had been talking, my publisher and I, about trying to let other writers write books about other characters from Battle School in Ender's Game. And Neil Schusterman, a wonderful YA writer from L.A., was the one that we had wanted, and he wanted to do it, but we just couldn't make the numbers work out right, because when you have something written in a series but not by the original author, the sales are merely a fraction of what the original author's sales would be.
Yeah.
And so when we realized that it wasn't going to work for us to have somebody else write in the series, I realized that I wanted to have that book about Bean exist. And so that's when I went back, but I had no such plan when I was writing Ender's Game. Most of my career is sort of done whimsically in that sort of way, but once I fix on a story that I want to tell, once I have a character that starts to come to life for me, then it becomes fairly easy.
To sort of provide some context for those of our listeners who may not have read any of these books, can you sort of describe the basic story? I mean, this may not be a fair question, but
it's a terrible thing because science fiction always sounds stupid when you tell the plot.
Yeah.
Because it's always stuff that didn't happen or couldn't happen. And so when you tell a story without all the supporting material, without all the details
sure.
that back it up within the context of the book, then it starts sounding sort of comic bookish, for that matter. Comic books sound that way when you can't see the supporting material with them. But basically what I'm doing with this is following the career of a child among children during a future in which the world is threatened by an alien invasion. See, already it kind of sounds dumb. And these children are identified early in life by rigorous testing as being those that have the innate capacity to be military commanders. And they're trained quite young so that they can be put into service young when they're still young enough to have no fear of death and no dread of consequences the way adults do. Children are, of course, as we know, quite reckless. That's why parents get gray hair. And so exploiting that attribute of childhood, we have a group of really brilliant children, several hundred of them, culled from the entire world, gathered in Battle School, which is an orbiting space station. And from there, we then move in Shadow of the Hegemon to the story after that war, where the nations of the Earth are jockeying for supremacy over each other, and they realize that their prized asset is these children identified as being brilliant military commanders. So Shadow of the Hegemon begins as one nation realizing that these commanders are their potential enemies in battle, realize that if they have to either capture them or make sure that nobody else gets the use of these military assets. It's quite a ruthless approach, but in fact, it makes perfect military sense. And so the children are put in great personal jeopardy, and the novel begins then with the problem of how to get them out of that jeopardy.
Well, we have a couple callers waiting, and I'll get right to them, but I can't resist one more question. The book Ender's Game is really the story of Ender Wiggin, who is the protagonist in the book. There are many fine characters, among them Bean, which then becomes the focus of Ender's Shadow and Shadow of the Hegemon. But there's Ender's brother, Peter Wiggin, who is also a major character, also very brilliant, but somewhat of a troubled personality. I just wonder, in the remaining books, will Peter get to tell his story?
Yes, I'm using his point of view, in fact, in Shadow of the Hegemon, so that we get inside his head, we get a sense of who he thinks he is. Now, naturally, his picture of himself is quite different from the picture that his brother Ender had of him, or his sister Valentine.
Sure.
But yes, we'll be following him right through his becoming Hegemon.
Good. I'll look forward to that even more, knowing that. So we'll let's talk with a couple of listeners. We have two people waiting and some lines open. We're talking this morning with Orson Scott Card. If you'd like to join our conversation around Champaign-Urbana, you can call us at 333-9455. Anywhere else you hear us, 800-222-9455. First up, a listener in Champaign on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. Just like to say, first, I'm a big fan of Mr. Card. I first read the short story, Ender's Game, when I was traveling, and then lost the book and was really glad to find it come out as a novel later. I had a couple of questions. One, I'd heard at some point that there was talk of making a movie out of Ender's Game. I'm just wondering where that stands. Is that's moving forward or dead in the water?
Oh, it moves forward both in my dreams and my nightmares, but you sounded as if you had another part to the question.
No, I was just going to ask, what's next after The Shadow of the Hegemon? I mean, have you got any ideas of where you're going to go after? You said four books.
Yeah, there's a total of four in that series. And, of course, I found out on this, just because I had people were asking me about my different series, that I actually have two books left in every series that I'm writing.
That's just great.
An amazing coincidence. Maybe that I just can't rest unless I have two books left in each series or something, but I intend to close them up. I intend to finish them. But as to the movie, this can be fairly lengthy, but the real problem that we've faced with the movie is that it's just hard to get $100 million funding for a film that has no stars.
Sure.
And Ender's Game being a story that is about children and children being hard to find, children who can act, it becomes sort of a nightmare for the studios to look at this and realize he doesn't have to find just one really brilliant child actor for this film. He has to find ten or a dozen. And that's scary, because when you think back through the history of Hollywood, we haven't had that many really gifted child actors. We've had, you know, Roddy McDowall, Margaret Sullivan, Margaret O'Brien, what am I talking about? Elijah Wood, Henry Thomas, Haley Joel Osment.
Right.
You know, that's a pretty slim list, and none of those were children at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. They come along one after the other.
I mean, the other child star at the same time as Elijah Wood was Macaulay Culkin, who, while charming, was talent-free, and and he would not work out very well with the things that are required of the kids in Ender's Game, and so we just have that as a great dilemma. And there's really no way around that. We just have to hope that we're able to find kids that can be worked with. That means we have to have a first-rate director who's wonderful with actors. And directors who are wonderful with actors are not the guys who usually direct science fiction, because in science fiction you're directing special effects. And so they usually put these $100 million budgets in the hands of guys who are good at handling the logistics and getting the visual look of a film right,
right.
But who aren't particularly gifted with actors. That seems to be, you know, what science fiction normally gets. So when we take the script and the book to the directors that would be right for us, people like Penny Marshall, say, or Ron Howard, what we find out is that long before they themselves get a chance to look at it, their people reject the idea because they have an ironclad rule from the director that the director does not look at science fiction.
Right.
Not consider it.
Exactly.
And so, you know, and even when we say, oh, but this is different, they say, you know, every single one of these that we get says this is different. And so we run into that wall as well. But there are ways to get around that, and one of them is to have a script that nobody can resist. And we don't have that yet. I'm the writer of the script, so I've been learning screenwriting right along with the process. But the main problem is just that Ender's Game is a tough story to adapt. It's a very emotional book, and that's the strength of it. It's not the flashy hardware, and it's not the thrilling chases. You know, it's just what goes on inside Ender Wiggins' head, what these events mean to him. Well, what goes on inside a character's head is the one thing that a film cannot show, that a novel must show. So my novel is a very novelistic novel, and it doesn't translate well unless you find some means of getting around the fact that you can't see what Ender is thinking. We think we have a plan. In fact, right now, we've just signed on another producer in addition to the ones that have been working with me for 5 years, Richard LeGravenez, who is the writer of Fisher King and has written and produced many wonderful films. And he already has come up with an idea that I think is worth its weight in gold, though, of course, he won't get paid his weight in gold, even though he's rather a slender man. Nevertheless, we can't afford that. But his idea was to simply film Ender's Game and Ender's Shadow as one movie. Now, that sounds like it should make it even harder to fit the story into the 120 pages that you have to write it in order to sell it in Hollywood. But quite the contrary, it simplifies everything. And probably tonight, as I'm babbling to the people who come to the signing, I'll go into more detail than we probably want to do for precious airtime on the radio. But it's still an interesting project to do, and it's been fun for me, though it's sometimes extremely frustrating, to go through the process of how you adapt from one medium to another. It's worth saying that I'm not responsible for trying to cling to every detail of the story. People are always afraid that the novelist is going to be the one to say, oh, no, you can't do that because that's not what really happened, and people have to pat them on the shoulder and gently remind them that none of it really happened. That's why it's called fiction, and you can change it in order to make a good movie. I am perfectly aware that you can't film the book. You have to find a good story to tell that is very much like the story in the book, but that makes a good movie, and that's what we've been in search of. That's why it's taking so long.
Yeah, well, it's very difficult. I'm a screenwriter, aspiring screenwriter myself, and it's just you end up with 180 pages, and you wonder
how. Well, what Richard said about that, it was very reassuring to me. He said, "You don't write 120 pages; you write whatever the story takes to get out of your head and onto the paper." And he chose that number, 180 pages. He said, that's what usually comes out. And then you go through and find out which scenes are redundant or what scene can do double duty and cover the ground that the two scenes were doing and which one simply can be cut out entirely. And you work it down to where you have 120 pages. And it's 120 pages that are dripping with your blood because there's so much that you've left out that you felt was important to include. Well, you sell the 120-page script, and then you start putting back scenes in collaboration with the director, and you film about 150 pages. And then of course, these numbers aren't exact. And then the editor and director sit together and cut it back down to 2 hours and 10 minutes, and you have your finished film.
Well,
so that 120-page guideline is really an edit rather than an actual shooting script. That's not the script you shoot.
Right. Well, I'll just leave you one question and hang up, and that is, you mentioned that you wrote mostly four-book series, and I've noticed that what I think is a disturbing trend in fantasy, but sometimes in science fiction, that is authors like the Robert Jordans of the world just writing endless series.
And well, I haven't talked to Robert Jordan personally about this, but I have talked to his publisher, and he swears that Robert Jordan says that he's had the plan for this all along, and that he is not doing what I do, which is letting a series sort of grow like Topsy. Then there's George R.R. Martin, who is, according to rumor, sort of surprised at how long his novel is taking him to write. It is a disturbing trend only in the sense that it can become very expensive in both time and money to read series of books that where each volume is 800 pages and it seems to have no end. But at least my books are shorter. I give myself credit for that.
I give you credit too. I just sometimes I long for the days where people tell a good story and it ends in one book. I mean,
I do have some of those coming too. Just the one book standalones, like my novel Enchantment. There's no sequel ever. That book is done, and I'm working on one called Slow Leak, that is about magic breaking out in Baldwin Hills, a black suburb of L.A. Middle-class suburb or rather suburban neighborhood, and nobody will pay any attention to them, nobody in authority, so they have to deal with it themselves. It's a wonderful story, I think, and I'm having great fun with it, but it's a standalone book, no sequel. So every now and then we do try those just to keep our hand in and prove that we know how to write a novel instead of a saga.
Great. Well, thanks very much.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Bye.
Also, your book Past Watch was one of those. that was...
Yeah, it did stand alone. There will be two more Past Watch books, but they're not series in the sense that, it's one continuous story. Each one of them stands completely alone and could be read without reference to the others.
Very good. We have a couple other listeners waiting. Let's go next to someone in Urbana on line number two. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi there. How are you?
Good.
Well, I used to read science fiction, and it had been a long... I'd sort of set it aside for a long time, but a year and a half ago, I heard you on this program, and I was intrigued. I sort of recognized your name from some other science fiction work that I'd read of yours, Songmaster. Is that long ago one?
Yeah, that was my third novel.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, third, right.
Which I liked, but I didn't, you know, like I said, I'd kind of gotten away from it. So I got Ender's Game based on the year and a half ago, and it truly was delightful. I read it to my 9-year-old son, and he liked it a lot, too. And
that's cool. I love to think of my stuff being read aloud. I try to write
yes.
in kind of an oral style, so
yeah,
that's
I like
wonderful.
Reading aloud sometimes. Some books don't work very well. Including the next one which I read, which was Speaker for the Dead. Which
that's not for 9-year-olds.
Well, that's right. It's not for 9-year-olds, and I decided not to read it to him. But I just thought that was an immensely wonderful book, and everybody, you know, raves about Ender's Game, which I thought was more charming than immensely wonderful. But I thought Speaker for the Dead was immensely wonderful. I really, really, really like Speaker for the Dead, and I wondered if you have any sequel to that coming up.
Well, there are two sequels, actually, to Speaker for the Dead. In
I'm
fact,
sorry,
now
I'm not
I sort
very
of think
current
of them
on
as
me.
The Speaker Trilogy. The next two books, and that series is closed. It's over. The next two books are Xenocide, starts with an X, and Children of the Mind. And those are in print, and they are grown-up books. Some kids do have the maturity, I guess, to be able to go on to those. But a lot of kids, you know, who come to Ender's Game fairly young. I never intended Ender's Game to be a children's book, but it is embraced by many young people, and they often have a hard time going on to Speaker for the Dead. Speaker for the Dead is, though, it's the book I meant to write. I only wrote Ender's Game.
Oh, I understood.
Set it up, so it took me by surprise. But of course, I wasn't dismayed. I was merely surprised that Ender's Game garnered the awards in the field. And I thought, well, great. That means that Speaker for the Dead will just sink like a rock because it'll be perceived as just a sequel. But fortunately, the readers were very open minded, and Speaker was recognized the same way that Ender's Game was. It doesn't sell as well because it is more demanding of the reader. But I'm proud of it, and I'm glad that you went ahead and read that saw it as
the other two as well. What's your feeling about the other two? Do you like them equally as well?
They're yet a different kind of science fiction, and they're much more, what do I want to say? They're a branch of science fiction that's more metaphysical, and so they consider, the joke is that it's sort of talking heads. Just people sitting around having ideas. It's really not quite that. There is quite a bit of action, but they're very thoughtful books, so some people don't enjoy them as much as the others. In fact, it's because they are so much more adult and discursive that I went that we were going to go back and try to create more books that followed along the lines of Ender's Game. So simply because Ender's Game, in that sense, never had a sequel. It didn't have any more books about these brilliant kids who were under the kind of stress that they were under, and so we designed the Shadow book at first, and then Shadow Books to satisfy that desire of those readers, and including the younger readers, so that they would have something that they could continue to follow.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for giving the book a chance. You know, that's wonderful that you were willing to come back to science fiction after having moved beyond it.
We're about at a midpoint with Orson Scott Card this morning, talking about all of his books, but in particular focusing on Shadow of the Hegemon, his latest novel, just released about a week ago by Tor Books, T-O-R is the publisher. And Orson Scott Card himself will be doing a book signing at Pages for All Ages bookstore in Savoy, Illinois, this evening at 7 o'clock. So if you'd like, you can catch him there. And for the remainder of this time, we'll talk with him by telephone. We have a couple callers waiting and would welcome others around Champaign-Urbana. The number 333-9455. Toll free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. Next up, a listener in Champaign on line number 3. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello. Thank you. Good morning. Yes, I have a quick two-prong question for Mr. Carr.
Those prongs really hurt when you...
I'll be gentle with the prongs, I promise. Lately, I've been reading a series of columns you've been writing for BeliefNet about the Church of Latter-day Saints, and I was wondering, do you consider yourself a official spokesman for the Church of the Latter-day Saints, and how does that that investment in your religion inform your writing?
Well, first of all, I'm definitely not an official spokesman. That line is very clearly drawn. I'm just a regular, ordinary member of the church with a lot of opinions, which, of course, is what all regular, ordinary members of the church have. But because I'm a writer, I sometimes, have ideas that I can't really put into my fiction because I don't use my fiction to address specific ideas that are specific to my religion. So I'm glad to have the opportunity to be writing on beliefnet.com I really try not to write about things that are so opaquely Mormon that people outside the church would have no idea what I'm talking about. I try to write about issues that I think would be interesting to people of any religion or people of no religion, but they do deal with a specifically Mormon context. So in a sense, I am talking to my own people, but with a but in a way that I hope that those who are listening in from outside will also understand and appreciate. It's kind of tricky dealing with that sort of thing. I belong to a proselytizing religion, and we feel a strong need to let other people know what we believe and give them the opportunity, if they want, to learn about it. And there are some Mormons who think that I should be using my fiction for that purpose, but my feeling is that my fiction wouldn't work that way. If I were writing that way, only people who were already Mormon would read it. And that's not, fiction's not good at that. I mean, the whole agreement between the author and the reader is that we both agree that what I'm writing is lies. I made it up. And so when I'm writing fiction, it doesn't seem to me to be the place for me to deal with things in an overt way, at least, that I believe to be sacred and true. So I try to deal with that in other settings. I keep my political opinions as much as possible out of my writing, my fiction writing, too. I have a website, ornery.org, where I do my political diatribes for those who can bear to listen to me rant. So I try to keep those separate, but at the same time, those are, I do care about those issues.
So you equate yourself with more of a C.S. Lewis-type character who insinuates his Christianity, in a more light manner than actually trying to hit the reader over the head.
Well, actually, I kind of feel a little hit over the head by Christianity and C.S. Lewis's fiction. I love C.S. Lewis's work, I have to say, but I think his best novel is Till We Have Faces, which has no shred of visible Christianity in it. Though I do love the Narnia books, precisely because they're such wonderful allegories, I don't think they're effective in fictional terms, I don't think they're as effective in fictional terms as they would have been had that been a more unconscious thing. There's a distinction here, I think. I really do believe in the doctrines of Mormonism, and so that's going to show up in my work when I'm not paying attention. There are thousands of unconscious decisions that a storyteller makes, and those are going to reveal who the storyteller really is and what he really believes. And I trust that my unconscious will deliver into my fiction those things that matter most to me and that I truly believe about how the universe works and what's good and bad and that sort of thing. But I have no program. C.S. Lewis had a program. He was definitely allegorizing and trying to say things about Christianity in his fiction, and I don't have such a program. I simply trust that who I really am and what I really believe is going to be revealed for good or ill. I mean, I'm if I'm a jerk, that's going to show up in my fiction too. That sort of thing shows up in everybody's work. So only in the sense that I can't disguise who I really am and what I really believe does Mormonism figure into my fiction. Now, there are some spots in my fiction where I've overtly dealt with it. I have a book called Folk of the Fringe that consists of five stories set in a future of Utah in which the Mormon Church dominates as it does now, and Mormonism shows up, but there it's not about the doctrines of Mormonism at all. It's simply using Mormon culture as a group in the future, and just as I used Catholics, future Catholics in Speaker for the Dead, there's no sense that you have to decide whether you think Mormonism is true or not in order to read those. You simply can look at it as an interesting view of a culture that you may or may not be a member of.
Okay, well, I guess, this is turning into a multi-pronged question, I guess.
Well, that's fine. The truth is I tried to take prongs and split them myself.
One of the one of the most recent articles that was related to your columns and on BeliefNet that I found interesting is they're saying that there's a disproportionately large number of Mormon sci-fi writers, and that you were kind of the vanguard of that whole movement.
Yeah, actually, I don't think I was the first. I may be wrong, but I was under the impression that Zena Henderson at least was a Mormon at some point in her life. She wrote a series of stories about, quote, the people, unquote, some people gifted with extrasensory perception. But she passed away some time ago, I believe, and I know she lived in Utah. Whether she was Mormon or not, I don't know, but I may not be the first. But I think that it's partly just because there was a group of would-be science fiction writers who assembled in a science fiction writing class that I was supposed to teach, but I moved out of state before the class began, and another teacher, Marion Smith, stepped in to teach the group. And they formed a writing group that was mutually supportive, and some very good talents emerged from them. At the same time, science fiction is a genre that rather lends itself to expressing, let's say that religious people generally do not respond well to science fiction in one way, and that is that one of the rules of science fiction is that God cannot be a character, a transcendent God cannot be a character. If you have somebody that represents God, he has to turn out to be a computer or an ancient alien, or et cetera, et cetera. I mean, we've seen this a thousand times in science fiction. It's rather a cliche, but you can't have a character pray to an identifiable Christian or Jewish God and get an answer to his prayer and go, oh, wow, this religion is true within the context of a science fiction story. That means that you know, pious members of various religions are uncomfortable trying to write science fiction because they have to essentially excise God as a transcendent being from their fiction. Mormons aren't really troubled by that because our view of God is not of the Nicene Creed, and in a sense is not a transcendent God, but one that fits comfortably within the science fiction rules. And so, you know, jokingly I say we therefore have sort of a science fiction religion, but that sounds demeaning, and that's not really how I mean it. Science fiction is used as a pejorative in our culture as well as being fun. And so it's still, there's a kind of compatibility that makes it so that believing Mormons have fewer barriers to being part of the science fiction community than true believers in some other religions. That's my own speculation. That may have nothing to do with it. It may just be pure coincidence that there are so many. Let me mention just a couple of them. Dave Wolverton is a wonderful novelist. He's now also writing under the name David Farland. But his Golden Queen trilogy is, I think, one of the finest works of rip-roaring adventure, but thoughtful and character-driven science fiction that I've ever read. I think he's of the science fiction writers living and working today, I think he's one of the three or four very best. And he happens also to be a Mormon. And I think also did not come out of the group that I mentioned earlier, so he's one of the exceptions. And there are others who are coming up along the way, and some who have not yet made their big splash, but I know they're going to.
Hope the last caller will forgive me, but our lines are all full, and I want to include as many people as we can before we run out of time.
Thanks for the warning. I'll try to keep my talking a little bit less.
Well, that's all right. That's what you're here to do.
So.
Okay, we'll go next to a listener in Urbana on line number one. Good morning.
Good morning. First of all, before I ask the question I intended to ask, would you run the name of the author you just mentioned by again? Because
sure.
I didn't recognize it.
Dave Wolverton, Wolverton. Some of his work is temporarily out of print, but I'm doing everything I can to make sure that it all stays in print. He has just some brilliant things. Also a novel called Serpent Catch, and that was part of a series whose the series title I can't remember. And right now he also writes under the name David Farland, F-A-R-L-A-N-D. He has a fantasy series going under that name.
Mm-hmm. What I actually was wondering about was why haven't we seen you lately at conventions?
I haven't gone to science fiction conventions with one exception, well, two exceptions, in the United States for many years, and the reason was the same reason that this is my last signing tour. I found that I was going to them, and I would agree to go to a convention so that they could publicize the fact that I was going to be one of the authors there. And then when it came time to go, it was right at a time when I needed to write a book, and it just tore apart my writing schedule, because I write in bursts. I have to have about a month and a half clear with nothing to interfere with it. in order to write a novel. And if I have a schedule where I've got an event every 3 weeks, I'll never get another book done.
I guess that's preferable. I was trying to explain to a bunch of Fenn day before yesterday about your 1,000 ideas in an hour panels, and none of them had ever been to one. And
I haven't done one until recently. I did go to the Los Angeles Science Fiction Convention this last Thanksgiving weekend, but only because, for one thing, I wasn't going to be doing anything else over the Thanksgiving weekend. I don't try to write books then, and we were planning a family trip out to California anyway to have Thanksgiving in L.A. And so we used the convention as sort of our excuse, and it helped. Helped to bear some of the expenses of moving our whole family west for that family holiday. But I really don't have any plans to resume attending conventions on a regular basis. There's another good reason, because I end up saying the same things on the same panels to the same crowd. Because a lot of the fans go to more than one convention, I end up seeing the same faces in the audience while I'm giving the same speech. And I think, why am I doing this when I should be home with my family or writing something or trying to do something that's more useful? I love the science fiction community and have felt welcomed and embraced by them, and I do enjoy going back when I do get to a convention. But
if you're a good enough author, that your laundry list would probably be interesting. But
no, I don't know about that. It's not interesting to me, so I certainly wouldn't want to talk about it. But still, I recommend the science fiction conventions. You know, whenever they publicize them, they always show the people walking around in funny costumes, and it looks like it looks to people who have never been to one like a collection of wackos. But in fact, it is a collection of wackos, but no more wacko than the average collection of American citizens. But it's really a wonderful community, and if you haven't been to a science fiction convention and you enjoy science fiction at all, you really ought to go. And if the people in costumes put you off, that's fine. Just don't take part in what they're doing. It's an extremely tolerant community. It's a community that I think shows what tolerance can be when it's handled properly. There's no sense of political correctness that if you dare to criticize somebody else that there's something evil about you, because that's really the height of intolerance. Instead, it's genuinely tolerant, so that you can go to a convention and go ahead and say, I just can't stand the people in costumes running around, it just drives me crazy. And that's okay, because you're doing nothing to interfere with them, but you don't have to like them. And that is what I define a tolerant community as, is that you don't necessarily all like each other, but you get along, and you leave room for each other to live. So I think it's an example of people willing to be part of a community without always agreeing with each other's actions. It's a great chance to meet writers, hear how they think, get to know them as human beings, and it's a great chance for the writers to get to know their readers. Literary communities usually don't get that opportunity. When you're writing fiction, it's not like being a playwright or a screenwriter where you can sit there with an audience and watch them watch your work. Nobody appreciates it when I knock on their door and ask if I can come in and watch them read, especially if they read in the bathroom or in bed. It just feels to them like the writer's really rather prying. But you go to a science fiction convention, and man, you hear the opinions of your work. It's not worship, believe me. People feel perfectly free to walk up to you and say, boy, you really tanked on that book, didn't you? I can't believe that you'd do something that weak when you had such a good series going. And, there's no shyness about offering opinions.
We have several callers waiting. I can't resist one question before we move on to our next listener. I wanted to ask you about computers. You had actually a kind of an internet already described to some extent in Ender's Game before the internet really became, the big thing.
Yeah, but I was, there were online services. I was subscribing to Delphi at the time that I wrote the novel Ender's Game. So I'm no prophet. All I did was try to guess how things would work. And the one thing that I certainly got right was the fact that one of the main attractions of being online is that no one knows who you are. So you can have a public persona that is extremely different from who you really are, and I did exploit that in the novel Ender's Game. But I'm no prophet. I'm just somebody who guesses right now and then, most science fiction writers.
You were involved in it from those days on forward.
Yeah, I wasn't part of the internet because I wasn't at a university, and in those days, university and government people were the only ones with internet access. It wasn't until later that the internet sort of opened up to the general public.
You have a couple of websites, and maybe you want to mention those or say something about them.
I already mentioned ornery.org for those who want to hear political rants or offer them. I mean, I'm not the only one who does the ranting. It's a public forum. And I also have my main website, which is www. I wish we could just skip that part.
I know.
Everybody knows it's there. Hatrack.com. And that's, we have writers groups, sort of a community supervised by a good friend of mine, Kathleen Woodbury, and we have a young writers group that's supervised by Philip Absher, who is a teacher in the junior high school, and well, now, in fact, I think he's doing elementary school right now, and he does a wonderful job with young writers, encouraging them and letting them encourage each other in their work, and a lot of other things that I think might be of interest. And then I have frescopics.com, which is my film company's website, and for Mormons on the net, we have Nauvoo.com, Nauvoo.com. For really just conversations for those who are already in that community and anyone who would, you know, it's open to the public, but it's not about proselytizing and it's not about arguing between Mormons and non-Mormons who might disagree with us. It's simply about Mormon life. So it's not a contentious site. We actually boot people who start to try to start arguments. They disappear because it's a civilized discussion. Those are the sites that I'm running right now. Soon we're going to have a site that's just Ender.com or EndersGame.com that's devoted to the movie and things associated with that. But that's, you know, those websites are expensive. They generate no income for me right now. And so please come and cost me money. Oh!
Okay. And if anybody wants to get those, I'll post them on our own website along with this interview after the fact. So.
Oh, you put up a transcription then. That's great.
Actually, we're doing real audio. So.
Oh, even better.
Yeah.
I'd like to talk to you about that sometime. I'd like to know how to do it.
Happy to help. We're trying to do that as much as we can because it gives people access to a lot of great interviews. Anytime they want to listen to them.
Well, what is your website so I can link to it?
It's simply will.uiuc.edu.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's great. That's
all
great.
Right.
I will get that up.
Good. Well, let's continue talking with some listeners. Next up, someone in Urbana on line number 2. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. That's hatrack.com?
Hatrack, yes, like you hang a hat on.
Okay. I just wanted to tell you that every holiday season, the some local bookstores have something they call an angel tree, and where you can pick out a book for a kid, and they've got the names and interests, not the names, the age, sex, and interests of particular kids. And I always try to find one or two kids to give Ender's Game to.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you. It's wonderful you're taking part in that in the first place, and thank you for choosing my book as the one that you'd give.
Well, I think it's really important for all kids to know that other kids have problems with people picking on them and trying to figure out the world. And that's one of the things I really like about Ender's Game and Ender's Shadow.
Oh, thank you. And you just said something that I think is important about Ender's Game. A lot of people assume that when young people read Ender's Game, it's really bright young people, you know, the brilliant ones who are doing well in school, who feel isolated because they're sort of picked on by other kids who are perhaps envious or so and so forth. But in fact, I get a lot of letters from kids who were doing very badly in school and feel isolated because they're dyslexic or labeled in other negative ways. And they also respond to Ender, not because he's a genius, but because he's so alone. And so it really isn't a book that demands that you have to be labeled by society as brilliant before you can enjoy the book. It's quite the contrary. It is for kids who feel alone. And in the long run, that's practically every kid. I don't know a kid who at some point doesn't feel isolated from others and virtually friendless.
And I recommend that this angel tree to other people. You have to look for it. It's not always obvious at these bookstores. But there's even if you don't like this particular style book, there's a whole range of interests for kids, and you can find some kid who would like some book that you think is a great book.
That's a wonderful idea. I hope people pay attention to that next year. Don't forget.
Thanks. Bye.
Thanks for the call. We have just about 5 minutes left with Orson Scott Card. A couple of callers waiting. We'll go next to a listener in Champaign on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. Thank you. A couple of fairly simple questions, I think.
Let's start with just one and try to get all the callers that we can.
Okay. Well, the question is, let's see, if I have to pick one, it's going to be, have you ever considered revisiting Treason?
I have, but I think I'm going to revisit it in the form of trying to get a miniseries off the ground about Treason. I think it'll work as an animated series, and it's the kind of thing that I think would work on a cable network. And so that's what we're trying to do, is get a proposal together about that. I have a wonderful special effects house that I'm working with that would be great to animate it. And so we think that that's something we can get done. But in terms of doing a sequel, I don't think I'm going to be able to do that. I think I finished the story.
Okay, well, thank you very much, then.
Thank you. Appreciate your call.
I'm not familiar with Treason.
Oh, it was my second published novel, but it's a very strong story. I was not that great a writer, particularly at the time, and so in some ways my inabilities as a writer hamper it. I put it in first person. I know enough now to know that that was a terrible choice. It should have been in third person, but I was young. I was dumb. What do I say?
Okay. Well, we have another listener waiting on line number 3 from Taylorville. Let's talk with them. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
First, I'd like to remark on a couple of writers who I used to regard as favorites, but Arthur C. Clarke, I think, from somewhere around his middle career, his writing, although interesting, became rather bland. I never cared for Heinlein. These people really, some of the other greats really aren't that much stylists, and I had to amen your business about bleeding to get it right. I recall Robert Graves and his wonderful memoir, but mostly about the First World War. Toward the end, he was prescribing for other writers, and he said, "Your best friend is a waste paper basket."
It's so true.
I've got four people that I right off the top of my head that I'm quite mad of. I'm rather embarrassed to admit I haven't read any of your novels, but
most people in the world
dig your short stories. But Spenren, Farmer, Aldous, and the early Clark. I think Childhood's End up to that time was one of the most maddeningly beautiful sci-fi things.
See,
I
that tells me a lot about you as a reader, just because what you're reaching for is writers who are very cutting edge and very daring, as Clark was in those middle years. And Spinrad, remarkable fellow and good thinker and a terrific writer, does some amazing things. You're not going for just the popular ones either, but for some who do more challenging work. But that's cool. See, the thing is, you are what I was talking about in the science fiction fan. You like science fiction, but you don't like it indiscriminately. You discriminate very carefully, and you know exactly what you think about writers, and you can like a writer and criticize him. And that's, you're the kind of person that I love to meet at conventions. I appreciate your calling.
I'm sorry to say we only have a couple of minutes left, and we've gone through our callers, so you have a chance to talk a little bit about something that I'm interested in asking you, and that is about the ambiguity of the characters that you write about. They're very human. I mean, even when they're extraordinary, they're gifted or they're geniuses, they're still wrestling with the same moral dilemmas and human weaknesses that all of us face.
And that, also the obverse of that with my characters who might be perceived as villains, I can't stand to leave them as just bad guys. I have to get inside their head and show you how they live with themselves. I mean, everybody has a self story that justifies what they do. I mean, Hitler did, for heaven's sake. If you don't understand their self story, you don't understand who they are and what they're doing. And I think it's important to understand them. Not, you know, when I say understand, I don't mean understand and relate to them and forgive them, because people do some terrible things, and there are some people who are genuinely evil. I've known some in my life, so I try to explore that in good characters and bad. The good characters are not perfect, and the bad characters are not so completely evil that they knowingly relish being bad. They think of themselves as being justified and having a right to do the things they do, and that's what I try to write about, is the way that people perceive themselves and are able to make their choices and then live with them.
Well, I'm sorry to say we're out of time, and I've appreciated having the chance to talk with you again.
Well, I've had a great time, as I did before. I look forward to these.
Very good. And for those of you listening, if you'd like to attend the signing tonight, 7 o'clock, at Pages for All Ages Bookstore in Savoy, you'll have a chance to meet Orson Scott Card. And again, his latest book is entitled Shadow of the Hegemon.